100 years' worth of knowledge, maybe.
Damn, I said quietly. I knew that Bob had once been owned by a necromancer named Kemler. Kemler had fought the entire White Council in an all-out war, twice. They killed him 7 times over the course of both wars, but it didn't take until number 7. Generally remembered as the most powerful renegade wizard of the second millennium, Kemler had at some point acquired a skull inhabited by a spirit of intellect, which had served as his assistant. Eventually, when Kemler was finally thrown down, the skull had been smuggled away from the scene by a warden named Justin de Morne, the same Justin who had adopted me and trained me to grow up into a monster, and who had eventually decided I wasn't tractable enough and attempted to kill me. It didn't go as he planned. I killed him and burned down his house around his smoldering corpse instead. And I'd taken the same skull, hidden it away from the wardens and company, and named it Bob.
"Is that bad?" Butters asked.
"A bad guy had the skull for a while," I said. "Big time, dark mojo. So those memories Bob lost are probably everything he learned, serving as the assistant to a guy who was almost certainly the strongest wizard on the planet, strong enough to openly defy the White Council for decades."
"Meaning he learned a lot there," Butters said.
"Probably,"
Bob said cheerfully.
"But it's probably limited to pretty much destructive, poisonous, dangerous stuff. Nothing important."
"That's not important?"
Butters squeaked.
"Destroying things is easy," Bob said. "Hell, all you really have to do to destroy something is wait. Creation, now, that's hard."
"Bob, would you be willing to take on evil, Bob?" Bob's eyes darted nervously.
"I'd prefer not to. I'd really, really prefer not to. You have no idea. That me was crazy, and buff, he worked out."
I sighed. "One more thing to worry about, then. And meanwhile, I still don't know a damn thing about my murder." Butters brought the roadrunner to a stop and set the parking brake.
"You don't," he said. "But we do. We're here. Come on."
Chapter 18. I gritted my teeth and got out of Butters's car, then paused to look at my surroundings. The piled snow was deep, and the mounds on either side of the street were like giant-sized versions of the snow ramparts that appeared every year in the carpenter's backyard. They changed the outlines of everything, but something was familiar. I stopped and took at least half a minute to turn in a slow circle. As I did, I noticed a pair of fleeting shadows moving easily over the snow. Wolves. Murphy's comment about sending shadows to escort Butters home made more sense in context. I watched one of the wolves vanish into the darkness between a pair of half-familiar pines, and only then did I recognize where we stood. By then, Butters had taken Bob from his holder in the car and was carrying him in the handheld spotlight case again. He shone the light around for a moment until he spotted me, then asked,
"Harry?"
"This is my house," I said after a moment. "I mean, where my house was." Things had changed. A new building had been put up where my old boarding house, my home, had been. The new place was 4 stories tall and oddly cubical in appearance. The walls fell even farther out onto the lawn than those in the old building had, encasing it in a strip of yard only slightly wider than my stride. I moved close enough to touch the wall and pushed my hand inside. It hurt, but the hurt never varied as I pushed in farther. This was no facade. It was made of stone. I'm not kidding. Freaking stone. Basalt, maybe. I'm no stonemason. It was dark gray with veins and threads of green and silver running through it, but I could only see them from up close. The windows were narrow, maybe 9 inches wide, and deep. There were bars on the outside. I could see more bars on the inside, and there was at least a foot between them. The roof was lined with a staggered row of blocks, real by God crenellation. As the pièce de résistance, gargoyles crouched at the corners, and at the midpoint of each wall, starting up at the second floor and moving in three rows of increasingly ugly statuary toward the roof. Someone had turned the ruin of my home into a freaking fortress. A plaque hung over what had to be the main entrance. It read simply, Brighter Future Society. Butters followed my gaze to the plaque.
Ah, he said. Yeah, we named it that because if we didn't do something, there wasn't going to be much of a future for this town. I wanted Brighter Future Group, actually, for the initialism, but I got voted down.
Hell's bells, I said. I did some math. To build on the ruins of the boarding house, construction would have had to start practically the same day that I died. Actual stone is expensive to build with because it's difficult and time-consuming. This place was as big as a small castle. It should have taken months and months and months to build. It had gone up in six, probably significantly less given the weather. This place cost a damn fortune.
Meh, Butter said and walked to the front door. Hang around a bit and you'll take it for granted like the rest of us.
He entered a sequence of numbers on the keypad beside the door. They made a little mechanical clicking sound that reminded me of a manual typewriter. He put his hands back into his pockets and waited. A moment later, a heavily accented basso voice emerged from a crackling speaker box.
Who goes there?
Butters, he said, with Dresden Shade. Hi, Sven.
The speaker made a rumbling sound.
Voldo, it said, pronouncing it Voldo. The night is dangerous. One day you will stumble across a fox and it will eat you.
Roars of laughter erupted from the speakers. Evidently, several other men were with the door guard. Butters didn't laugh, but he did grin.
I'll just get stuck in his throat until you can haul your walrus ass over to him and save me, Sven.
Louder laughter erupted from the speaker, and a voice half-choked with it said something in a language that had come from somewhere in Northern Europe. There was a click, and Butters opened the door. I started to follow him in, and remembered, in time, to put my hand out and check the doorway first. My hand moved smoothly past the 12 inches of stone, but then hit something as solid as a brick wall where the doorway opened up into the entry hall. Butters, I said. He smacked the heel of his hand against his forehead.
Right, sorry. Please come in.
The invisible wall vanished, and I shook my head. It's got a threshold. People live here?
Bunch of them,
Butters confirmed, and we went inside.
A lot of paranetters come through for a little while when they don't have a safe place to sleep. Visiting netters who are passing through town. Venatori when they meet with us, that kind of thing.
I felt anger stirring in me, irrational but no less real.
My home is a supernatural flophouse? And armory, and jail,
Bob said enthusiastically. Ghosts can sputter in outrage.
Jail? And daycare,
Bob continued. I stopped in my tracks and threw my hands up.
Daycare? Daycare? People have kids, man, and they have jobs,
Butters said in a gentle voice.
The Fomor aren't above using children to get what they want. High-risk kids come here on work days. Now shut up, Bob. And get off your high horse, Harry. People need this place.
I turned my gaze to Butters and studied him for a minute. The little guy had come a long way from the somewhat timid, insecure man I'd first met years before. That Butters would never have said anything like that to me. Or maybe he was the same guy. Butters went right to the wall for the sake of the truth, even when it cost him his job and got him locked up in a nut house. He was a man of principles. And he was probably right. This wasn't my home anymore. We passed the guard station after we got buzzed through a security gate. Four of the biggest, toughest-looking men I've ever seen were stationed there. They wore biker leathers and swords. Their muscles swelled tight against their skin, their beards bristled, and their uniformly pale eyes watched us pass with calm attention.
Einherr Jarin, Butters said quietly. Soldiers of Valhalla, if they're telling the truth.
They are, I replied, just as quietly. Where did we get them?
Marcone, they aren't cheap.
Him again. Butters shrugged.
I don't like the guy either, Harry, but he's smart enough to realize that if the Fomor take control of the streets, they're going to get rid of him as a matter of course.
Too simple, I said. Too easy. He's running some kind of game on you. We went through another door and then up some stairs, which opened onto the second floor. The place was one enormous chamber, almost entirely free of interior walls. There was a small gym, complete with shower rooms and a boxing ring. Inside the ring, Murphy, wearing her street clothes, stood facing a man who had inherited a portion of his DNA from a rhinoceros, and not many generations ago. He was huge and heavily muscled, his dark hair and beard in long braids. He wore an old pair of jeans and nothing else. His upper body was coated with more dark hair. Not like a werewolf or a circus freak or anything. Just at the top end of the hirsute bell curve. A real hairball. Butters froze in place, waiting. Murphy stared steadily at the big man for several moments, her body relaxed, her eyes never blinking. He returned a blank stare of his own. Then they both moved. I couldn't tell who went first, but Murphy's fist streaked toward the big guy's groin. He twisted his hip, deflecting the blow, and when he returned it to balance, his leg scythed up in an arc that clipped the tip of Murphy's chin. She spun away and went down. Hairball did not hesitate for so much as a second. He moved toward her, fast for someone so large, and stomped his heel down toward her head. Murphy rolled and dodged the blow, but he followed up, and she had to keep rolling to stay ahead of his sledgehammer heels. She hit the edge of the boxing ring, then abruptly reversed her roll, moving toward him instead of away. She slipped the next stomp, scissored his knee with her legs, twisted her whole body, and brought him down. Hairball fell like a tree, huge and slow. The boxing ring ropes shook when he landed. Murphy came up onto all fours, scrambled a bit to one side, and then swept her foot at Hairball's head. He dodged, but her kick shifted direction, her leg moving up, then straight down, bringing her heel down like a hatchet onto the hand Hairball was using to support his weight. Bones snapped. Hairball howled, scrambled to his feet, and started swinging wildly at her. Murphy dodged and slipped one blow after another, and at one point abruptly turned and drove her heel into Hairball's solar plexus. The blow rocked him back a step, but Murphy followed it too closely, too recklessly. Hairball recovered from the kick almost instantly, slapped the blow aside, and seized her arm. He turned and flung her, one-handed, over the top rope of the ring and into the nearest wall. She hit it with a yell and bounced off onto the floor. Dead, I snarled, my fists clenched. I started forward and took three or four whole steps before I realized that I wasn't going to be able to hit the guy, or blow him up, or send him on a vacation to another reality. Hell, I couldn't even sneak up on him and shout, boo.
Harry, wait, Butters hissed. It's okay.
Murphy picked herself up from the floor, moving slowly. As she did, the giant hairball came over to the nearest side of the ring, holding his right hand in his left. Murphy brushed some dust from her clothing and turned to face him. Her blue eyes were steady and cold, her mouth set in a small smile. Her teeth were white, and rich red blood quivered on her lower lip where the impact had split it open. She wiped the blood off on her sleeve without looking away from Hairball.
Three? She asked.
Broke all four, he said, moving his right hand a little by way of demonstration. Took out my best sword hand. Good. If you hadn't gotten greedy for the kill, maybe you'd have taken this round.
Murphy snorted.
You've been drinking bad mead, Scaldi Scaledson.
That made Hairball smile.
Sword tomorrow?
Murphy nodded. The two of them stared at each other for a moment, as if each expected the other to suddenly charge the second the other turned his back. Then, with no detectable signal passing between them, they simultaneously nodded again and turned away from each other, relaxing.
Butters, rumbled Scaldi Hairball.
If he really had broken fingers, it didn't look like they were bothering him much.
When are you going to get in this ring and train like a man?
About 5 minutes after I get a functional lightsaber,
Butters replied easily, much to Hairball's amusement. Then the little medical examiner nodded to Murphy and said,
"Can we talk in the conference room?"
"Sure," she said. She walked by the ring and bumped left fists with Scaldi. Then she led Butters and me out of the gym, down another hallway, and into a long, narrow conference room. She shut the door behind us, and Butters popped Bob's flashlight onto the table. His eyelights winked on again, and I saw Murphy react visibly when that light revealed my presence. She stiffened a little, looking at me, and her eyes showed a sudden weariness and pain. She took a deep breath through her nose and closed her eyes for a second. Then she took off her jacket, moving gingerly, and said, "Hi, Harry." Butters put the radio on the table, and I said, "Hi, Murph." She was wearing thin, light padding under the jacket, like the stuff I'd seen on stuntmen on a case I'd done not long after I'd gone into business. So her full contact practice hadn't been as vicious as it had looked. She'd be covered in bruises, but the impact with the wall hadn't actually been likely to break her back. Her skull, maybe, but not her back. "You okay?" She rolled one shoulder with a grimace of discomfort.
"I will be."
"Big guy like that going to town on you," I growled. "Someone needs to push his face in." Her eyes glittered as she gave me a sharp look. "Dresden, when exactly am I going to fight someone my size and strength?"
If you want to wrestle hostile mooses..."
"Moose," Butters corrected absently. "Singular and plural, same word." "Gorillas," Murphy continued, hardly breaking stride. "Then the best way to train for it is by wrestling slightly less hostile gorillas. Scaldi's 200 pounds heavier than me, almost 2 feet taller, and he has going on 2 millennium..."
"Millennia," Butters said. "Millennium is the singular."
Murphy pushed a breath out through her nose and said, "Millennia of experience in breaking the backs of annoying little doctors with annoying little grammar fetishes." Butters grinned. "I'm not going to beat him, Harry, ever. That isn't the point." She looked away and her voice became quiet. "The point is that the world isn't getting any kinder. A girl's got to take care of herself." The expression on her face? It hurt. Hearing the words that went with it felt like a knife peeling back layers of skin. I didn't say anything. I didn't let it show. Murphy would have been offended at the notion that she needed my protection, and if she thought I felt guilty for not being there to protect her, to help her, she'd be downright angry. Don't get me wrong, I didn't think Murphy was a princess in a tower, but at the end of the day, she was just one person, standing in defiance of powers that would regard her with the same indifference as might an oncoming tsunami, volcanic eruption, or earthquake. Life is precious, fragile, fleeting, and Murphy's life was one of my favorites.
"Okay, Harry," Murphy said. "Where do we get started?"
I felt awkward standing there while she and Butters sat at the table, but it wasn't like I could pull out a chair. Maybe we get started with what you know about my shooting." She nodded and pulled on her cop face, her expression professionally calm, detached, analytical.
"We don't have much, officially speaking," she said. "I came to pick you up and found the blood and a single bullet hole. There wasn't quite enough to declare it a murder scene, because you were on the boat and it was in motion. There was no way to extrapolate precisely where the bullet came from, probably a nearby rooftop. Because the bullet apparently began to tumble as it passed through your body, it left asymmetric holes in the walls of the boat. But forensics thinks it was something between a .223 assault rifle round and a .338 Magnum rifle round, more likely the latter than the former." "I never got into rifles. What does that mean?" "It means a sniper rifle or a deer rifle," Butters clarified. "Not necessarily military. There are plenty of civilian weapons that fire rounds in those calibers."
"We never found the bullet," Murphy said. She took a deep breath.
"Or the body."
I noticed that both Murph and Butters were staring at me very intently. I said, I sort of did the whole tunnel of light thing, which is a crock, by the way. I bit down on a mention of Murphy's father. I was sent back to solve the murder, which sort of implies a death, and they said my body wasn't available, so... Murphy looked down and nodded.
Huh,
Butter said, frowning. Why send you back? I shrugged. Said what came next wasn't for whiners or rubberneckers. Murphy snorted. Sounds like something my father would say. Yeah, I said. Eh. Butters arched an eyebrow. His dark eyes flickered between me and Murphy, and thoughtful lines appeared on his face. Anyway, I said, that's what you know officially, right? So, what else do you know? I know it wasn't Marcone, Murphy said. All of his troubleshooters have alibis that check out. So do he and Guard and Hendricks. I know which building the shot probably came from, and it wasn't an easy one. 450 yards, Butters said, which means it was probably a professional gunman. There are amateurs who can shoot that well, Murphy said. As a rule, they don't do it from buildings at their fellow Americans, Butters replied. Look, if we assume it's an amateur, it could be anyone. But if we assume it was a professional, which is way more likely in any case, then it gives us the beginning of an identity and could lead us back to whomever he works for. Even if we do assume that, Murphy said, I don't have the access to information that I used to. We'd need to review TSA video records, security cameras, all kinds of things I can't get to anymore. Your brother-in-law can, I said. Dick can. Richard, she corrected me. He hates that nickname. Dick who? Butters asked, looking between us. I said, her brother-in-law. At the same time, she said, my ex-husband. Butters's brow arched even farther, and he shook his head. Man, Catholics. Murphy gave him a gimlet look. Richard runs by the book. He won't help a civilian. Come on, Murph, I said. You were married to the guy. You've got to have some dirt on him. She shook her head. It isn't a crime to be an asshole, Harry. If it was, I'd have put him away for life. Butters cleared his throat.
We could ask.
No, Murphy and I said at the same time, and continued speaking over each other. The day I ask for that bastard's help will be the day I... Told you before, over and over, that just because he's reasonable doesn't mean he's a murderer and a drug dealer and a pimp, and just because Chicago's corrupt government can't put him away doesn't mean you were smarter than that, Murphy finished. Butters lifted his hands mildly.
Okay, okay. I was on board at no.
No going to Marcone for help. He paused and looked around the room as if he'd never seen it before.
Because that would be unprecedented.
Wally, Murphy said, one eyebrow arching dangerously. He held up his hands again.
Uncle! I don't understand your reasoning, but okay.
You think Marcone was behind it, Harry? Murphy asked. I shrugged. Last time I saw him, he said he didn't need to kill me, that I'd get myself killed without any help from him. Murphy frowned. It made her lip hurt, and she winced, reaching up. The wince made it hurt worse, apparently, because fresh blood appeared.
Damn it. Well, you can take that a couple of different ways, can't you?
Like how? Murphy looked at me. Like maybe Marcone knew something was happening already, and that's why he said he didn't need to kill you. It wasn't him, but it was still something he was aware of. I grunted. Marcone ran Chicago like his own personal clubhouse. He had legions of employees, allies, and flunkies. His awareness of what happened in his city wasn't supernatural. It was better than that. He was rational, intelligent, and more prepared for a crisis than any man I'd ever seen. If the Eagle Scouts had some sort of Sith equivalent, Marcone was it. If someone's wet work specialist had come to town, Marcone was very likely to have learned of it. He and his underworld network missed little. Damn it, Murphy said, evidently coming to the same conclusions I had. Now I have to talk to the scum. She got out her little notepad and scribbled on it. Butters, you said that Lindquist's house had burned down?
Big time, said Butters.
I nodded. According to the ghosts hanging around it, the gray ghost showed up. I didn't tell you about the gray ghost, did I?
Mr. Lindquist filled us in after the shooting, Butters said.
Oh, right. Anyway, it showed up with several mortals and snatched him. We've got to get him back. Murphy nodded, still writing. What happens if we don't? A bunch of serial killer-type ghosts start wandering around Chicago looking for a good time. Ghosts like that can manifest, make themselves the next best thing to real, Murph. Like the nightmare. People will get hurt, a lot of them. Murphy's mouth thinned into a line. She wrote on her notepad. We'll do triage in a minute. What else? I found the gang who shot up your house last night, I said. The tip of Murphy's pencil snapped against the notepad. She looked up at me, and her eyes were cold, furious. She spoke in a very quiet voice.
Oh?
Yeah, I said. I paused for a moment to think about what I was going to say. Murphy's temper was not a force to be invoked lightly. I don't think you're going to have to worry about them anymore.
Why? She asked in her cop voice. Did you kill them?
There'd been a little too much intensity in that question.
Wow.
Murphy was clearly only too ready to go after these guys the minute she knew where they were. I glanced at Butters, who looked like someone sitting near an armed explosive. No, I said, working out my words carefully. If Murphy's fuse was really as short as it seemed, I didn't want her charging off to deal with Fitz and his poor crew in true Viking tradition. But they don't have the resources they had before. I don't think they're going to hurt anybody in the immediate future.
That's your professional opinion, is it?
Yes.
She stared at me for a minute and then said, Abby was standing on my patio last night when they came by. She took a round in the belly during that attack. She didn't get down fast enough. They don't know if she's going to live or not. I thought of the plump, cheerful little woman and swallowed. I didn't know, Murph. I'm sorry. She continued speaking as if I hadn't said anything. There was a retiree living in the house behind mine. He used to give me tomatoes he grew in his garden every summer. He wasn't as lucky as Abby. The bullet hit him in the neck while he was sleeping in bed. He had enough time to wake up, terrified, and knock the handset of his phone out of his cradle before he bled out.
Hell's bells. That put a different spin on things.
I mean, I had been hoping to go for a no-harm, no-foul argument with Murphy.
But if blood had been spilled and lives lost, well, I knew Murphy. Whether or not she was a cop anymore, she wasn't going to back away.
Where are they? She asked. This is not a time to kick down doors, I told her. Please, hear me out.
Her hand tightened into a fist, but she visibly took control of her anger, took a deep breath, and then nodded.
Go ahead.
I told her about Fitz and his gang. I told her about Aristides.
I notice, Harry, she said, that you didn't tell me where they are.
Yeah, I said. I sort of told the kid I would help him, that you would help him. Murphy narrowed her eyes.
You did what? They're kids, Murph, I said. In over their heads. They need help.
They've killed at least one person, maybe more, Murphy said. There are still laws in this town, Dresden.
Send the cops in and it'll get ugly. I'm not sure how much juice their boss has, but even if he can't shoot, he'd be a nightmare for the police, even S.I.
Murphy frowned. How sure are you about that?
Guys like him use fear and violence as daily tools. He won't think twice about hurting a cop.
Murphy nodded.
Then I'll deal with him.
Murph, I know you can handle yourself, but Dresden, I've dealt with two men since the shooting, who were skilled enough for Carlos to call them the next best thing to full council-quality warlocks. I've handled several lesser talents, too. The Fomor like to use them as officers and commanders. I know what I'm doing.
You've killed them, I said quietly. That's what you mean, isn't it?
She looked away. It was a moment before she answered.
With someone that powerful, there's not really a choice.
If you try to take them alive, they have plenty of time to kill you. I winced in sympathy for her. She might not be a cop anymore, but it was where her heart lay, with the law. She believed in it, truly believed that the law was meant to serve and protect the people of Chicago. When she was a cop, it had always been her job to make sure that those laws worked toward that purpose, in whatever way she could manage. She loved serving her city under the rule of law, and that meant judges and juries got to do their job before the executioner stepped in. If Murphy had dispensed with that belief, regardless of how practical and necessary it had been, regardless if doing so had saved lives. Butters had said that she was under stress. I now knew the nature of that stress. Guilt. It would be ripping away steadily at her insides, at her conscience, scraping them both raw. They were all killers, she said, though I don't think she was talking to me. Killers and kidnappers. And the law couldn't touch them. Someone had to do something. Yeah, I said, someone always does. The point is, she continued, that the way you deal with this kind of problem is to hit it with absolutely everything you've got, and to do it immediately, before those spell-casting yahoos have enough time to ford up, bend people's minds into defending them, or to start coming after you or someone you care about. She looked up at me. I need the address. You don't, I said. I'll bring the kids to you. Once you get them away from Aristides, he's out of help and vulnerable. Then you can help Fitz and company. Fitz and company, she said in a flat tone, are murderers. But no, Harry, don't give me any rap about how they didn't mean it. They opened fire with deadly weapons in a residential neighborhood. In the eyes of the law and anyone the least bit reasonable, it was an accident is unconvincing. They knew what could happen. Their intentions are irrelevant. I know, I said, but these aren't bad kids. They're just scared. It drove them to a bad choice. You've just described most of the gang members in this town, Harry. They don't join the gang because they're bad kids. They do it because they're frightened. They want to feel like they belong somewhere, safe. She shook her head. It doesn't matter if they started out as good kids. Life changes them, makes them something they weren't. What do you want to do? Take a team to their hideout, deal with the sorcerer. We'll make every effort to avoid harming the others. You're going to open fire with deadly weapons on their home. Maybe you don't want to hurt the kids, but you know what could happen. If you wind up with bodies on the floor, your intentions would be irrelevant. Is that what you're telling me? Her eyes flashed with sudden anger. You haven't been here the past 6 months. You don't know what it's been like. You... She pressed her lips together, and she looked at me and stared, clearly waiting. I said very quietly, No. She shook her head several times, then she said, The real Dresden wouldn't hesitate. The real Dresden would never have gotten a chance to see them, to talk to them. He'd just skip to the fight. She flipped her notepad closed with a snap of her wrist and stood. Then we've covered what needs doing. There's nothing more to discuss. Murphy got up and left the room without a word, her steps smooth and purposeful. Butters rose and collected Bob and the little spirit radio.
I usually follow along after her when she's setting up something. Take care of the details. Excuse me.
Sure, I said quietly.
Thanks for your help, Butters.
Anytime, he said.
You too, Bob, I said. De nada, the skull replied.
Butters hurried out. I was left standing in the conference room alone. Chapter 19. I stood there for several minutes, doing nothing, not even breathing. Doing nothing is difficult. Once you aren't busy, your head starts chewing things over. Dark, bleak thoughts appear. You start to think about what your life means. If you're a ghost, you start to think about what your death means. Murphy was being slowly devoured from within by a guilty conscience. I had known her a long time. I knew how she thought. I knew what she held dear. I knew what it looked like when she was in pain. I had no doubt that I made the right call on that one. But I also knew that she was a woman who wouldn't kill another human, even if he were over the hill and around the bend crazy, unless it was absolutely necessary. No killing is easy for anyone of conscience, but Murphy had been facing that demon for a long time. Granted, she'd been hurt by my death, and let me tell you how furiously frustrated it made me that I was powerless to have changed that. But why would her conscience start catching up to her now? Why develop a sudden case of the damsels when I'd asked her to get more information from her ex-husband? Brick walls didn't stop the woman when she had a mind to walk somewhere. I noticed something, too, when we had been talking about the shot that had killed me and the shooter's location, and gathering more information about potential assassins. Murphy hadn't said much, but she'd not said a whole hell of a lot more. She had never, not once, mentioned Kincaid. Kincaid was a partially inhuman mercenary who worked for the scariest little girl on God's green earth. He was centuries old, and he was a phenomenon in a fight. He had somehow overcome the negative aspects of the human nervous system, at least as it applied to firing a weapon under pressure. I'd never seen him miss, not once. And it was he who had told me that if he wanted to kill me, he'd do it from at least half a mile away, with a heavy-duty rifle round. Murphy knew, as well as I did, that the opinion of an assassin with centuries of experience would be invaluable in the investigation. Initially, I hadn't suggested it because Murph had kind of been dating the guy for a while and seemed to care for him, so it seemed more appropriate to let her bring it up. But she hadn't. She'd never mentioned him at all. She'd run the meeting too rapidly and was ready to fight with me over something, anything. The entire argument about Fitz and his crew had been a smokescreen. The only question was for whose benefit it had been. Mine? So that a possibly crazy ghost wouldn't go storming off for vengeance of some kind? Or had it been a veil of fog for her own benefit, because she couldn't reconcile her view of Kincaid with that of the faceless person who had killed me? That felt right. That she knew it in her heart and, without realizing it, was frantically scrambling to find a less painful truth with her head. My reasoning was based on my knowledge of human nature and of Murphy's personality and on my intuition, but I'd spent a lifetime trusting my instincts. I thought they were probably right. I played through the possibilities in my head. I imagined Murphy, distraught and falling to pieces on the inside in the days after my murder. We never got to find out if we'd be anything together. We'd missed it by moments. I knew that when there had been enough time for her rage to abate, the sorrow would begin to pile up. I imagined her in the next month or so, no longer a cop, her world in shambles. Word of my death would have gotten around fast, not only among the wizards of the White Council, but among the remaining vampire court, over the Paranet, and from there to the rest of the supernatural world. Kincaid probably heard about it within a day or two. As soon as someone had filed a report about me, the Archive, the supernatural recorder of all written knowledge that dwelled within a child named Ivy, would have known. And I was probably one of the only people in the world she thought of as a friend. She was, what, 12, 13? News of my death would shatter Ivy. Kincaid would, I think, have gone to Murphy to offer what comfort he could. Not the hot chocolate and fluffy robe brand of comfort. He was more likely to bring bottles of whiskey and a sex music CD. Especially if he was already right here in town, a dark, nasty part of me whispered in my head. I imagined Murphy taking shelter where she could and bidding him farewell when he left. And then, over the next few weeks, slowly lining up facts and reaching conclusions, all the while repeating to herself that she was probably wrong, that it couldn't be what it looked like. Frustration, pain, denial. Yeah, that would be enough to draw rage out of anybody. Rage she would be carrying with her like a slowly growing tumor, becoming more and more of a burden. It was the sort of thing that might push someone to kill another person, even when maybe it wasn't necessary. That death would cause more guilt, more frustration, which would cause more rage, which would cause more violence, which would add to guilt again. A literal vicious cycle. Murphy didn't want to get shots from airport and train station security cameras because she didn't want to find out that the man she'd been sleeping with had killed one of her friends. When drawn close to that plausibility, she reacted in anger, pushing away the source of illumination about to fall on what she didn't want to see. She probably wasn't even aware of the clash of needs in her head. When you're grief-stricken, all kinds of irrational stuff flies around in there. Detective work isn't always about logic, not when you're dealing with people. People are likely to do the most ridiculously illogical things for the most incomprehensible of reasons. I had no logic to aim at Kincaid, but the theory fit a whole lot of pieces together. If it was correct, it explained a lot. It was only a theory, but it was enough to make me want to start digging for more evidence where I might not otherwise have looked. But how? How was I going to start digging into Jared Kincaid, the hellhound, the closest thing to a father Ivy ever had, and do it without Murphy's help? For that matter, I'd have to find some way to do it without her knowledge, and that seemed like something that would be more than a little slimy to do to a friend. Ugh. Better, maybe, to focus on the immediate problems first. I had to find Morty, whose plight had clearly been low on Murph's priority list. I had to help Fitz and the rest of his clueless teenage pals. And for all of it, I needed the help of someone I could trust. I took a deep breath and nodded. Then I walked until I had passed through an exterior wall of the Bright Future house and set off to find my apprentice before the night got any deeper. Chapter 20. I always considered myself a loner. I mean, not like a poor me, Byron-esque, I should have brought a swimming buddy loner. I mean the sort of person who doesn't feel too upset about the prospect of a weekend spent seeing no one and reading good books on the couch. It wasn't like I was a people hater or anything. I enjoyed activities and the company of friends, but they were a side dish. I always thought I would also be happy without them. I walked the streets of a city of nearly 3 million people, and for the first time there was nothing that connected me to any of them. I couldn't speak to them. I couldn't touch them. I couldn't get in an argument over a parking space or flip the bird to a careless driver who ran a light while I was crossing. I couldn't buy anything in one of the stores, making polite chit-chat with the clerk while paying. Couldn't pick up a newspaper, couldn't recommend a good book to someone browsing the shelves. 3 million souls went about their lives around me, and I was alone. Now I understood Captain Murphy's Shadow Chicago. The actual town had already begun to feel like the shadow version. With enough time, would the real city look that way to me too? Dark, empty, devoid of purpose, and vaguely threatening? I'd been here for barely a day. What would I be like if I was here for a year, 10 years, 100 years? I was starting to get why so many ghosts seemed to be a couple of French fries short of a happy meal. I had to wonder, too, if maybe Sir Stuart and Morty were right about me. What if I really was the deluded spirit they thought I was? Not the true Harry Dresden, just his image in death. Doing what the lunatic had always done, setting out to help his friends and get the bad guy. I didn't feel like a deluded spirit, but then I wouldn't, would I? The mad rarely know that they are mad. It's the rest of the world, I think, that seems insane to them. God knew it had always seemed fairly insane to me. Was there any way I could be sure I was anything other than what Sir Stuart and Mort thought? More to the point, Mort was the freaking expert on ghosts. I mean, I knew my way around the block, but Mort had been a specialist. Normally, on purely technical matters regarding spirits and shades, I would give his opinion significant weight, probably a little more than I would my own. Morty had never been a paragon of courage and strength, but he was smart, and clearly tough enough to survive a long career that had been a lot more dangerous than I thought. Hell, for all I knew, while I had been busy saving Chicago from things no one knew were there, Mort might have been saving me from things I never knew were there. Funny world, isn't it? I stopped in my tracks and shook my head as if to clear water from my eyes. Dresden, have your personal existential crisis later. The bad guys are obviously working hard. Get your ass in gear. Good advice, that. The question was, how? Normally, I would have tracked Molly down with a fairly simple piece of thaumaturgy I'd done 1,000 times. After her unplanned vacation to Arctis Tor in Faerie, I had always been sure to keep a fairly recent lock of her hair handy. And more recently, I'd found I could get a fix on all the energy patterns she used to make her first few independent magical tools, like the hair. They were something specific and unique to her and her alone. A signature. I could be pretty sure to find her when I needed to do so. Hell, for that matter, I'd spent so much time around her that she had become almost like family. I could generally tell by pure intuition when she was nearby, as long as she wasn't actively trying to hide herself. That, of course, had all been when I had magic. Now I didn't. Which was, upon thinking about it, probably another bit of evidence in favor of Stuart and Mort's theory and against mine. You can't take magic away from a person. It's a part of who and what they are. They can abandon it if they work at it hard enough, but you can't strip it out of them. If my ghost had truly been me, it would have had power, just as that bastard Leonid Kravos's ghost had. Right? Or maybe not. Maybe I'd been making more assumptions without ever questioning them. I had already assumed that matter was solid when it wasn't, that I could get cold, which I couldn't, and that I was still beholden to the laws of gravity, which I wasn't. Maybe I'd made the same assumptions about magic. I mean, after all, I had thrown a solid shield spell during the first attack on Mort's place, when I'd been sharing space with the Ectomancer. That would seem to show that my talent was still there, still real. I just had to figure out how to access it. Memories are power. I dug into my duster's pocket and drew out the massive pistol Sir Stuart had given me. Black powder weaponry isn't my thing, but I made sure there was nothing in the priming pan before turning it barrel down and shaking it. I had to give it several hard thumps with the heel of my hand to get the ball, wad, and powder to spill out into my palm. The ball, the bullet, gleamed as if newly molded. Upon closer look, fine swirls on the surface of the metal took on the shapes of a simple pastoral scene, a colonial-style home in the middle of a little green valley surrounded by apple trees, clean, neat cropland, and a pasture dotted with white sheep. Just looking at it seemed to give the scene life. Wind stirred the crops, apples stood out like specks of bright green against the darker leaves. Lambs gambled among the adult members of the flock, playing for the pure joy of it. The door to the house opened, and a tall, straight-backed woman with hair blacker than a raven's wing emerged from the house, trailing a small cloud of children, clearly giving calm instructions. With the sight, a flood of emotions coursed through me, a fierce and jealous pride of possession. Not pride that I owned such a beautiful home, but that the home was beautiful because I owned it, because I had made it so. Mixed with that was an ocean-deep surge of love for the woman and her children, raw happiness at seeing them, and a heavy, entirely pleasurable surge of desire for the woman, whom I had not held in far too long. I suddenly felt that I had intruded upon something personal and intimate. I closed my eyes and looked away from the scene. Memories, I realized. These were all things from Sir Stuart's mortal memories. This memory was what he had cast forth against that wraith the first time I met him. He hadn't used memories of destruction as his weapon, but those of identity, of the reasons he was willing to fight. That was why, as a ghost, he still used that axe, this pistol. Far more modern weapons were available to copy, but his memories were of himself using those weapons. And so they were the source of his power, the embodiment of his will to change what was around him. They were Sir Stuart's identity. They were also his magic. Memories equaled power. For a moment, I thought it couldn't be that simple. But a lot of magic is actually disgustingly simple, which is not to be confused with easy. There was only one way to find out. The first spell I'd ever done had been during that long-ago class Olympics, but that was spontaneous, accidental magic, hardly worthy of the term. The first conscious spell I'd knowingly worked, fully planned, fully visualized, fully realized, had been calling forth a burst of fire. Justin Dumorne had shown me how it worked. I plunged into the memory. "I don't understand," I complained, rubbing at my aching temples. "It didn't work the first 50 times. It isn't going to work now."
46 times, Justin corrected me, his voice very precise, like always.
He had an accent, but I couldn't figure out which kind it was. I hadn't heard one like it on TV. Not that Justin had a TV. I had to sneak out on Friday nights to watch it in the store at the mall, or else face the real risk that I'd miss Knight Rider altogether.
"Harry," Justin said.
"Okay," I sighed. "My head hurts."
"It's natural. You're blazing new trails in your mind. Once more, please."
"Couldn't I blaze the trail somewhere else?"
Justin looked up at me from where he sat at his desk.
We were in his office, which was what he called the spare bedroom in the little house about 20 miles outside Des Moines. He was dressed in black pants and a dark gray shirt, like on most days. His beard was short, precisely trimmed. He had very long, slender fingers, but his hands could make fists that were hard as rocks. He was taller than me, which most grown-ups were, and he never called me anything mean when he got mad, which most of the foster parents I'd been with did. If I angered Justin, he just went from saying please to using his fists. He never swung at me while screaming or shook me, which other caretakers had done. When he hit me, it was really quick and precise, and then it was over, like when Bruce Lee hit a guy. Only Justin never made the silly noises. I ducked my head, looking away from him, and then stared at the empty fireplace. I was sitting in front of it with my legs crossed. There were logs and tinder ready to go. There was a faint smell of smoke, and a bit of wadded-up newspaper had turned black at one corner, but otherwise there was no evidence of a fire. In my peripheral vision, I saw Justin turn back to his book. "Once more, if you please." I sighed, then I closed my eyes and started focusing again. You started with steadying your breathing. Then, once you were relaxed and ready, you gathered energy. Justin had told me to picture it as a ball of light at the center of my chest, slowly growing brighter and brighter. But that was a load of crap. When the Silver Surfer did it, energy gathered around his hands and his eyes. Green Lantern gathered it around his ring. Iron Fist had glowing fists, which was pretty much as cool as you could get. I guess Iron Man had the glowing thing in the middle of his chest, but he was, like, the only one, and he didn't really have superpowers anyway. I pictured gathering my energy together around my right hand. So there. I pictured it glowing brighter and brighter, surrounded by a red aura like Iron Fist's. I felt the power making tingling sensations up and down my arms, making my hairs stand up on end. And when I was ready, I leaned forward, thrusting my hand into the fireplace, released the energy, and said clearly, "Sedget." And as I spoke, I flicked the starter on the Bic lighter I had palmed in my right hand. The little lighter immediately set the newspaper alight. From right next to me, Justin said, "Put it out." I twitched and dropped the lighter in pure surprise. My heart started beating about a zillion times a minute. His fingers closed into a fist. "I don't like to repeat myself." I swallowed and reached into the fireplace to drag the burning paper out from under the wood. It singed me a little, but not enough to cry about or anything. I slapped the fire out with my hands, my cheeks turning bright red as I did. "Give me the lighter," Justin said, his voice calm. I bit my lip and did. He took the lighter and bounced it a couple of times in his palm. A faint smile was on his lips. "Harry, I believe you will find that such ingenuity may be of great service to you as an adult." The smile vanished. "But you are not an adult, boy. You are a student. This sort of underhanded behavior will not do at all." He closed his fist and hissed, "Sidget!" His hand exploded into a sphere of scarlet and blue flame, which pretty much made Iron Fist's powers look a little bit pastel. I stared and swallowed. My heart beat even faster. Justin rotated his hand a few times, contemplating it, and making sure that I saw his whole fist and arm, that I could see it wasn't sleight of hand. It was completely surrounded in fire. And it wasn't burning. Justin held his fist right next to my face until the heat was beginning to make me uncomfortable, but he never flinched and his flesh remained unharmed. "If you choose it, this is what you may one day manage," he said calmly. "Mastery of the elements, and more important, mastery of yourself."
I said, "What?"
"Humans are inherently weak, boy," he continued in that same steady voice. "That weakness expresses itself in a great many ways. For instance, right now you wish to stop practicing and go outside, even though you know that what you learn here is absolutely critical. Still, your impulse is to put play first, study later." He opened his hand suddenly and dropped the lighter in my lap. I flinched away as it struck my leg and let out a little yell, but the red plastic lighter simply lay on the floor, unmarked by any heat. I touched it with a nervous fingertip, but the lighter was quite cool. "Right now," Justin said, "you are making a choice. It may not seem like a large and terrible choice, but in the long term, it may well be. You are choosing whether you will be the master of your own fate, with the power to create what you will from the world, or whether you will simply flick your beak and get by, unremarkable, complacent." His mouth twisted and his voice turned bitter. "Mediocre. Mediocrity is a terrible fate, Harry." My hand hovered over the lighter, but I didn't pick it up. I thought about what he had said, then I said, "What you mean is that if I can't do it, you'll send me back." "Success or failure of a spell is not the issue," he said. "What matters is the success or failure of your will. Your will to overcome human weakness. Your will to work, to learn. I will have no shirkers here, boy." He settled down onto the floor next to me and nodded toward the fireplace. "Again, if you please." I stared at him for a moment, then down at my hand, at the discarded lighter. No one had ever told me I was special before, but Justin had. No one had ever taken so much time to do anything with me, ever. Justin had. I thought of going back into the state system, to the homes, the shelters, the orphanages, and suddenly I truly wanted to succeed. I wanted it more than I wanted dinner, more even than I wanted to watch Knight Rider. I wanted Justin to be proud of me. I left the lighter where it was and focused on my breathing. I built up the spell again, slowly, slowly, focusing on it more intently than on anything I'd ever done in my life. And I was nearly 13, so that was really saying something. The energy swelled until I felt like someone had started a trash fire in my belly, and then I willed it out through my empty, outstretched right hand. And as I did, instead of using the Egyptian phrase, I said, "Flick'em bickus!" And the remaining tinder under the logs burst into bright little flames. I didn't think I'd ever seen anything more beautiful. I sagged and almost fell over, even though I was already sitting on the floor. My body suddenly ached with hunger and weariness, like this one time when all us orphans had gotten to go to a water park. I wanted to eat a bucket of macaroni and cheese and then go to sleep.